Society for the kind invitation that you have given me to speak to you tonight. I'm sure you're all familiar with a story that was going the rounds there a couple of months ago when the announcement came from Rome of the forthcoming canonization of Blessed Oliver Plunkett. There were supposed to be two Dublin men visiting Drogheda. They just heard the announcement that had come from Rome, and one says to the other, "Come in, Paddy," says he, "and we'll go into St. Peter's Church, where the shrine of Blessed Oliver Plunkett is." Says, "We'll go into St. Peter's Church. You know, they have the head here," says he, "of this man that's going to be canonized from Rome, Blessed Oliver Cromwell." Perhaps the measure of the amount of information that is fairly current around Dublin about Blessed Oliver Plunkett. I know that the situation is quite different in the north of Ireland, where he worked as a bishop. But I thought perhaps, since the subject is pretty relevant at the moment and rather topical, and also because of the fact that recently I've been reading a full collection of the letters of Blessed Oliver, which are being published very shortly by the Vice Rector of the Irish College in Rome. And since he mentions in those letters some of his visits to County Antrim, I thought you might be interested in hearing what he had to say about County Antrim, about the people even around the north, east coast of Antrim, and what kindness he experienced among them. I don't want to give you any kind of biography of Blessed Oliver tonight, because biography of them are to a penny, of course, and there's going to be a whole spate of them coming in the next couple of months, because biographers are not going to miss the opportunity. The commercial possibilities of the life of Blessed Oliver during 1975. In fact, I'm among them myself. There'll be plenty of tale about his life, but just to put his period into context for a few minutes, first of all, he was born, of course, in the year 1625 in Loch Crewe, which is in the parish of Oldcastle in County Meath. And he was educated in his early years by a first cousin once removed, who was Abbot of St. Mary's in Dublin, later on a parish priest in County Meath, and ultimately became Bishop of Arda and then Bishop of Meath. And then during the Confederate period, during the 1640s, in 1647, along with a small group of Irish boys, he went off to Rome to study there for the priesthood. And he was 7 years, first of all, as a student in Rome, doing the usual courses, sometimes in the Irish College, and ultimately in the Collegio di Propaganda Fide. And then finally he was ordained priest on New Year's Day of 1654. Of course, 1654 had brought a very big change in the political situation in Ireland from what it had been a few years earlier. It was the middle of the Cromwellian persecution, and therefore he petitioned his superiors in Rome to allow him to remain on there until things would improve at home. He was appointed ultimately a professor in the College of Propaganda Fide, and he spent from 1654 until 1669 as professor of theology and what he calls himself controversy in the College of Propaganda. And then in 1669, the Archbishop of Armagh at that time died in exile in France, Edmund O'Reilly. And a lot of candidates were suggested as suitable successors to him, and ultimately at a meeting of the congregation in Rome, the Pope personally intervened and said, "Why are we, as it were, discussing uncertainties when we are able to back a certainty? We have here a man that we know to be eminently suitable for the post. Him I nominate as the new Archbishop of Armagh." There was, in fact, a certain amount of opposition in Ireland to his appointment, which has only recently begun to emerge from the Roman archives. If you recall what the historical situation in Ireland at that time was, you'll remember that during the 17th century, there was a tremendous amount of opposition between the old Irish of the north and the Palesmen of Leinster of the Pale. Now, for roughly a century before Blessed Oliver's time, the old Irish of the north had had their way and had in turn a whole series of old Irish archbishops appointed to Armagh, a couple of O'Reillys among them just before Blessed Oliver. And on various occasions I'd written to Rome and said, for God's sake, don't give us any more Pale's men as archbishops of Armagh. They don't understand the North, they don't understand the old Irish, they don't understand our language and culture and so on. And above all, don't give us a Meath man. And in 1669, Leonard Oliver, a Meath man, was in fact a pipe to our man. I'm mentioning that just to show you, as it were, the historical background, that long before he reached Ireland at all, he was bound, therefore, to meet with a certain amount of opposition, even among his own flock. Well, he started off home from Rome, therefore, in the summer of 1669. He came up rather slowly. He was doing the grand tour of Europe on the way home. He came up by Austria, in fact, by Innsbruck, and then across to Munich, through southern Germany, up the Rhineland, ultimately arriving in Cologne by the Rhine, and then he took a boat from Cologne to Holland, down to Rotterdam, and came across country to Brussels. And from Brussels he made his way to Ghent, and it was in Ghent, in the modern Belgium, that he was finally consecrated as Archbishop of Armagh on the 1st of December 1669. And then after spending a week or so waiting for a favourable wind in Ostend, he came on that well-travelled route from Ostend to Dover and up to London, where he arrived in November 1669. But he spent the winter in London. It's rather curious, in fact, that for a few days in the winter of 1669, this man, who was actually being hunted at the same time in Ireland because the king's officers in Ireland thought he had already arrived there, was in fact spending a couple of days in the royal palace of Charles II in Whitehall, because, as you know, King Charles was married to Queen Catherine of Braganza, a Catholic queen, and she had a number of Catholic chaplains in the palace, including the famous Dominican, Father Philip Thomas Howard, and Howard had known Blessed Oliver in Rome and invited him to visit him in the palace, and in fact kept him over for a few nights. It's very, very ironical indeed that we have a series of letters written from the palace to Dublin, to the Viceroy there, urging them to be very watchful about the arrival of this Popish bishop, and they were actually written at the same time that the Popish bishop was staying in the Royal Palace in London. Oh, that's only by the way. He finally, at any rate, after spending the winter months in London, came up through floods and snow in February and the beginning of March, again on the route that's so well known to Irish exiles nowadays, up to Holyhead, and got a boat from Holyhead that at that time didn't land at Dunleary, but in fact landed down at Ringsend, down there where that very dirty gas works now is, near the Shelbourne football pitch, if you know that part of Dublin. And there he arrived early in March 1670. Now, Blessed Oliver Plunkett happened to be, perhaps unlike some of us, in that he was an inveterate letter writer. He couldn't get a letter that he didn't insist on answering in three or four pages at least. And the result is that we have, from his pen still surviving, hundreds of letters written by him during his 10 years in Ireland, from the spring of 1670 until the autumn or early winter of 1679. Most of them survive in Rome, but a small number of them, in fact, also survive in England. As far as I know, there's not a single one of his letters surviving in Ireland. There were reports a few years ago that a collection of them, in fact, had been found up here in County Antrim, in Glenarm Castle, because, as I'll mention later on, he had some close associations with the Earls of Antrim of that period, and on one occasion at least came up to visit the second Earl of Antrim, and a report was published in the newspapers, I remember some years ago, that in fact some of his letters had turned up here, but when investigations were made, they were simply letters that mentioned him, but no letter, as far as I know at any rate, in his own hand turned up. The vast majority of his letters are written in Italian, because after spending such a long time in Rome, obviously he was a very fluent Italian speaker. A fair number of them are also in Latin. There is a small number of them in English, and I'm sorry to say there's not a single one of them in Irish. Now, that doesn't mean that he wasn't in fact a fluent Irish speaker, because he mentions on many occasions having preached in Irish, having heard confessions in Irish, And of course, being a native of that border area between the Pale and the old Irish territory of Cavan, up in North Meath, an area where Irish was still fairly widely spoken until the early 19th century, he must have been very familiar with the Irish language before going to Rome. But it so happens not a single letter of his written in Irish, in fact, survives. About 220 of his letters have been recently collected by Monsignor John Hanley, the Vice Rector of the Irish College in Rome, and these will form the basis of his book on the letters of Blessed Oliver Plunkett that will be published later this year. Now, recently I have got my hands on a typescript copy of that work, and I thought perhaps that I would go through it, pick out some of the letters of most interest for Antrim people, and that on those I would base this little talk tonight. Let's begin, therefore, by dipping into a letter which reveals a lot about the character and personality of Blessed Oliver just at the time of his arrival in Ireland. On his arrival, the Viceroy at that time was Lord Roberts, who was a rather bigoted anti-Catholic Viceroy. I mention that in comparison with some of those who came after him. And for that reason, for the first few months after Oliver's arrival as Catholic Archbishop of Armagh, he had to go around in disguise. In fact, from London on, he took the name of Captain Brown. He dressed as an army captain, he donned a sword, pistols and a wig, and he tried to pass himself off for the first few months he was in Ireland as an army officer just over visiting from England. And later on, when some of the opposition that I mentioned already he had to expect in Ireland, when some of these people, even Catholics, began to criticise him for various things, one of the criticisms they made of him was that during his first period in Ireland, he had been mixing around a little bit too freely among the laity, that he had become rather friendly with some of the ladies. And therefore they wrote to Rome that, well, in Oliver's early days in Ireland, perhaps he had mixed a little bit more than a Catholic archbishop would be expected to. And in answer to this accusation, Oliver wrote a very revealing letter. I think it's a very human letter, and I'm reading it first of all tonight, as it were, to show you just the humanity of the man. He says, "In the time of Roberts, the first Viceroy, who was my enemy and persecuted me, I went under the name of Captain Brown, with my sword, my wig and my pistols, a situation which lasted only 2 or 3 months. In the houses which I entered, and in the inns, I used to kiss the women, because it was the custom to do so. I used to sing, and once when I was in the company of certain non-Catholics, who showed some doubt about my identity, I took upon my horse with me the wife of the gentleman of the house where I was living at the time, and we rode for a mile in the company of the brother of the lady who was a Catholic. This took place 2 years ago, so I beg you to note what is written, and if the writer speaks in general terms, then hold him suspect." Well, a rather interesting introduction, as it were, to the character and personality of Oliver. There is a great humanity about all his letters. There's a great sense of humour in many of his letters, as you'll see later on. And I'm emphasising this side of him first of all tonight, because we're inclined to think, when a man is declared a saint, we're inclined to think of him as being way out there in the outer regions, as it were, as somebody that is so far removed from us that we can have no association with him at all. In fact, the personality of Oliver Plunkett that emerges from his letters is that of a personage who was very sadly persecuted, who suffered an awful lot for his principles and for his faith, but who, behind it all, was a most human personality indeed. Despite the difficulties that he met with during that early period, he succeeded in doing a full visitation of his own diocese of Armagh during those early months. And he sent a long report on it to Rome in May 1670, which I won't bother about tonight. because I'm more concerned with the Diocese of Down and Connor. But finally, in the summer of that year, Roberts as Viceroy was replaced by Lord Berkeley, who was a man much more friendly disposed towards Oliver, who was, in fact, even though he was Viceroy, actually married to a Catholic. And from that stage on, for the next 3 years or so, Oliver had comparative freedom as Archbishop to move around openly, to hold meetings of his clergy, to carry out visitations of the other Ulster dioceses that fell within his province, to start a series of schools for the training of young people in County Louth, at the beginning near Dundalk, later on to Drogheda, and ultimately in those schools he had 150 young men being instructed, including about 50 priests, some of whom were in fact from County Antrim, and about 40 sons of the local Protestant aristocracy of that area were also attending the schools. From the beginning also, he was going to be a reformer of the Irish Catholic clergy. And I suppose, like all reformers, naturally his reforming program made further enemies for him. For instance, just on his arrival, he discovered that the secular clergy and the regular clergy were very much at loggerheads. And he laid down a whole series of regulations which to a great extent were resented by the regulars. And he also discovered that within the regular fraternity, the Dominicans and Franciscans were at loggerheads. And both groups were in fact laying claim to 3 friaries in the north of Ireland. We needn't go into them, but again, he had to investigate the claims of both sides, and ultimately he gave his decision in favour of the Dominicans. And again, obviously, he made enemies from that stage on of the Franciscan order, at least of many individual Franciscans. Now, I mention these points, of course, in order to, so that we'll see later on how so many Franciscans and so many clergy in general became involved in the plot against his life. As well as being a reforming bishop, he was also going to be very much an ordaining bishop. Every single year from his arrival in Ireland in 1670 until the year of his arrest, 1679, we have records of ordinations by him. In fact, he must have ordained literally hundreds of priests. We haven't a full list of them, but we do have a pretty full list of all the clergy in Ireland in the year 1704. Now, that is roughly 30 years after Blessed Oliver's time. But even as late as the year 1704, there were still 122 priests in Ireland who had been ordained by Blessed Oliver Plunkett. So when you allow, of course, for all the deaths that took place during the intervening period, obviously the number of his ordinations must have run to many hundreds. Among those, there are 5 priests ordained by him for County Antrim parishes. I'll mention who they were actually later on. He also, during those early years, held the first of his provincial synods. This was the Synod of Clonus, held in that County Monaghan town in August of 1670. And finally, he became involved, as I suppose nearly every Ulsterman has to become involved at some stage or other of his career, in the political situation in the north of Ireland, which was, at that time, almost as disturbed as it has been, unfortunately, in recent times. Because, remembering what the situation was, you're 10 years after the Stuart Restoration, after Charles II's return to the throne, many of the old Irish of the north had been hoping to be restored to their lands. For the most part, they were sadly disappointed, and some of them had taken to the hills and were carrying on a kind of guerrilla warfare in the 1660s and early 1670s. And Blessed Oliver, immediately after his arrival in Ireland, met a large group of these Tories on the Tyrone-Fermanagh border and finally persuaded them to hand over their arms and to agree to go abroad and take service in the armies of France and Spain. And this again was a decision that some of the old Irish of the north never really forgave him for. Now, after the Synod of Clonus and the meeting with the Tories in August and September of 1670, he decided then to go right round the northern province and visit as far as possible every diocese and every parish. And it's for that reason that he finally arrived for the first time in County Antrim in September of 1670. The first letter he wrote from County Antrim is dated the 19th of September 1670, and as it provides a useful account of everything he had done in the few months that had then passed since his return to Ireland, again I'd like to read you a paragraph or two of it. He says, again he's beginning first of all by defending himself against certain charges made against him. "I have had a letter from you," he writes to the internuncio in Brussels, "in which there are certain accusations against me made by people who never write the truth. Lies, however, have short legs. God knows if I have been idle here. I have visited my whole diocese. I have settled all the disputes in the diocese of Kilmore, County Cavan. I have restored peace among the Clogher priests, County Monaghan and South Tyrone, and I have also confirmed thousands in it. I did the same in the diocese of Derry, and now I have moved into the diocese of Down. I held," you notice he calls the United Diocese of Down and Connor sometimes simply Down. "I held a provincial synod at Clonus, and many salutary decrees were drawn up there for the whole province. I claim to have accomplished more in these few months than all the other bishops in Ireland at present. I preached to very wicked outlaws and have brought them back to repentance. I have saved from extermination over 1,000 Catholic families through the clemency of the Viceroy and of the Governor of the province. I have never gone to Dublin unless called there by the Viceroy." One of the accusations made against him was that he was always running off to Dublin and attending at court there instead of sticking to his own province in the north. "I have gone only 3 times, even though my diocese is as close to Dublin as Tivoli or Frascati are to Rome. I beg you, Monsignor, therefore, to do me that justice which is done to the most miserable individual you can find. That is, not to condemn me until you have heard my case. And if in time you do not find that all these charges are false, I shall then willingly admit my guilt. Envy is such that tyrants have failed to invent a greater torment than it. God has prospered all my undertakings, and since I have not broken with the government, I can do everything without fear. And if I did not have the credit which I have with the Viceroy, I should now be in the same condition as the Archbishop of Tuam, who had just recently been arrested." Oliver spent a good part of September, and I should think most of the month of October, in counties Down and Antrim. He had been furnished by Rome with a long questionnaire of over 90 questions, which he was to answer about each diocese that he moved into. And his report on the diocese of Down and Connor, on the combined diocese of Down and Connor, survives in Rome. A portion of it was published by Monsignor O'Lafferty in his History of Down and Connor and will be familiar to you, but in fact there is some interesting material also that is not included there, because Monsignor O'Lafferty took his material from Cardinal Bourne's edition of Blessed Oliver Plunkett's, the Blessed Oliver Plunkett material in Rome. And that was published as far back as 1861, and Cardinal Bourne was a great defender of the Catholic Church, so anything that he felt didn't do credit to Blessed Oliver or the Catholic Church at that time, he was inclined to leave it out. And for that reason, well, there are certain things about the Diocese of Down and Connor that Monsignor O'Lafferty didn't get. First of all, the first question concerned the size and location of the diocese. He says it is 50 miles long and 15 wide. Obviously, there were Irish miles, and very long Irish miles at that. "To the east, it has partly the diocese of Dromore," again, he wasn't too well orientated, "and the sea. To the west, it has the diocese of Derry, and to the southwest, Armagh. To the north, it has the sea, and to the south, it has part of the diocese of Armagh. He was asked about the appearance of the countryside, and he says simply, "It is more mountainous than plain." He must have come across the road I came across the mountain tonight from Bush Mills. He must have come across that way. He was asked about the crops, and he says, "It abounds in milk products, oats and barley." He was asked, "Was the diocese peaceful?" And he says, "There is peace." He was asked about trade and commerce, and he says, "There is commerce in it, and it has good ports, Carrickfergus, Belfast, Dunipidy, and Strangford." No word of Cushion Doll or Cushion Doll. The post to the diocese, he says, comes through Dublin, from which letters are distributed throughout the country. "Who is the ruler of the diocese?" He answers, "It is under the King of England." "What language is spoken?" He answers, "The English and Irish languages." "What is the organization of the church there?" And he answers, "There are parishes, and they are not strictly missionary. Each parish priest has more than one parish, one not being sufficient for his maintenance." And I'm sure some of them will tell you at the present day the same way. Question number 13 asked how many Catholic families in the diocese, and the answer was 2,500, which sounds a little bit small to me, but then you must remember that the population of all Ireland towards the end of the 17th century probably was under a million, or very slightly over a million, so in that context perhaps it is a reasonable figure. These are families, not people, which would give you perhaps 10,000 Catholic people in the diocese at the time, but it still sounds a little bit small. "Who is the landed proprietor there?" And the answer is, "The Marquis of Antrim, a good Catholic and very influential. There is no other there who possesses property," which strictly speaking would be correct, because as you know, after the Cromwellian confiscations, hardly any Catholics got a restoration of their lands in the north of Ireland, only four or five in all. Oliver, in one of his letters, mentions only three. The Earl of Antrim, one of the O'Neills, and a McGuinness of Ivey in County Down. But he was probably the only proprietor who owned lands in County Antrim at the time who was a Catholic. He was asked, "Are there any scholars of repute there among the non-Catholics?" And he says, "There is nobody among the non-Catholics who is renowned for learning." He was asked, "Was there religious tolerance?" And his answer, mind you, is very good. He says, "There is, thank God, great tolerance." Later, he was to pay tribute to the Protestants of Antrim, but we'll come to that in its own place. He was asked what rite they belong to, and he said, "They belong to the Latin rite." "Any heresies there?" And his answer is, "There is no doctrinal error among the Catholics or Irish population." He was asked whether other churches, and his answer was, "There are Protestants, Presbyterians and Quakers." Well, then there came a whole series of questions with regard to church buildings, endowments, lands, incomes and so on, and he linked them all together. Questions 23 to 40, "No other answer is necessary beyond that the Protestants in this area have all the churches and their income." Questions 40 to 47 concerned the bishop and the cathedral, and his answer to that was, "There is no bishop, but a vicar general named Patrick O'Mulderig, who is pretty well known. It is the surname, of course, that has later on been translated as Reed, because of the similarity between the Irish adjective jarrig, meaning red. Some of the Muldericks of County Antrim and Down have anglicised their name as Reed. "He is an old man of 60 years, a good man, experienced, though not of great education. He lives with his brother in a private house. He has many converts to the faith." In a later letter, Oliver was to say that there was a lot of tumult in the diocese of Donnacona when he arrived, because the Down men had refused to obey this Antrim vicar general, Muldering, and had proceeded to set up a Down vicar general of their own. "The cathedral churches of Donnacona," he says, "are ruthless. That of Down is very famous because in it are buried Saints Patrick, Columbkill and Bridget, as is recorded by an ancient verse. These three in Down in one tomb rest, Patrick, Bridget and Columbkill blessed. In Down too was born Scotus, the famous doctor. Well, that is historically not accurate, or at least not accepted nowadays. He's referring, of course, to Duns Scotus, and it's now generally accepted by scholars that Duns Scotus was born, in fact, in Scotland. Then he was asked about religious orders in the diocese, and he proceeds to list them. In County Down, there is a convent of Dominicans, that would be the one at Newton Ards, but the friars live in a hospice. They quest for alms, and they are in continual controversy with the Franciscans regarding the limits of questing rites. They are five in number, and apart from Clement O'Byrne, who is a great preacher and is doing great good, there is no other outstanding man among them. There is also a convent of Franciscans in Down, this would be Downpatrick Friary, with 12 friars in it, among whom the outstanding ones are Paul O'Brien and Paul O'Neill and James O'Herry in preaching and doing good work. With these, the Dominicans are always fighting and grave scandals arise. In the convent of Carrickfergus in the Diocese of Connor, there are 10 Franciscan friars, of whom 5 are priests. Among these, friars Hugh O'Dornan, of whom 5 are priests. Among these, friars Hugh O'Dornan and Daniel O'Mallon are outstanding in preaching. There is also Friar Paul O'Harn, a man of literary talent. The Dominicans have a convent in Coleraine, in which there are only 4 friars who are priests. One of these is named James Crawley, and he is a good preacher. Then the next question asked, or the next series of questions asked, how are the Catholic clergy supported? And the answer to that was, there is no need to say very much, since I shall give a separate report with a list of the parish priests. I merely say that they are maintained by a stipend given them by the Catholic laity. Every house gives 4 duly each year. This would be roughly 4 sixpences, about 2 shillings. Besides the casual offerings, which they receive for baptism, 2 duly, a shilling. For marriage, 4 duly, 2 shillings. For extramunction, 2. And for burying the dead, when each one gives an offering as he wishes. He was asked whether any clerical students or young men suitable for the priesthood in the diocese, and he says, I reply that there are many young men suitable for studies, but there is a great lack of Catholic schools because the authorities do not permit Catholic schoolmasters. There is, however, a certain William O'Lafferty, a priest and a good teacher of the humanities, who keeps school in Down, but there are few scholars in it. Questions 82 to 84 concerned nuns. And his answer to that is very interesting indeed, because he says, I reply that there are no nuns beyond 4 Franciscan zealots. Now, nuns in Ireland become very, very scarce after the confiscation of the religious houses in the 16th century. And that is one of the extremely few references there are to nuns anywhere in Ireland during most of the 17th century. I'll mention that later on, because I'd like your own ideas as to where that little group of nuns might have been. Then he was asked with regard to the persecution of the Catholic faith in the diocese, and he referred back to Cromwellian times. And finally, the last questions referred to obstacles to the spread of the Catholic faith, and those we needn't go into. Now, his report on the diocese was accompanied by a list of all the priests of the Diocese of Down and the Diocese of Connor. There were 15 of them in the Diocese of Down, and there were 14 of them in the Diocese of Connor. We'll leave the Down men out tonight and just concentrate on the Antrim men, and they were as follows. The first one was Hugh Lorinan, which would be the modern name McLarnan. An outstanding theologian, but a frequenter of taverns. The next one was, he Latinizes his name as Porricus MacNulog. It's rather hard in the case of some of these names when they are passed through a Roman clerk to just identify what was the original Gaelic form, you know, but Porricus, I think, possibly means something like scurvy, this kind of thing. So some of you have a lot of names in Irish, like Brochoc, that kind of thing.
and McNullo could be McNally, or it could be a shot at McCullough, even McAnulla, something like that, of good life and sufficient learning. Three was Felix McKilley, of a good life and sufficient learning. Four was James McLurinon, of sufficient learning, but suspect as to chastity in his youth. He has mended his ways these 12 years past, but is somewhat given to drinking. Blessed Oliver, as I said, was a reformer, and you'll notice that his standards, his clerical standards, were of the highest, and he demanded very, very high standards from his priests, nothing higher than he was prepared, of course, to provide as a lead himself. But he is quite critical, as we'll see in a moment, of any priest that in matters of education, or in such things as perhaps being too fond, as he thought, of what we call nowadays the bottle, he has no hesitation in saying so. He wants the very, very highest standards. Priest 5 was Cormac O'Shiel, of good life and sufficient learning. Priest 6, Bernard O'Neill, good life, but weak as regards learning. He hadn't got too far at the books. Priest number 7 was James O'Hare, of sufficient learning. In his youth he was married and had children, but for the past 12 years he has mended his ways. He is somewhat given to drinking. Priest number 8 was Patrick O'Cahan, of good life and sufficient learning. Priest number 9, Cormac O'Heal, of sufficient learning and good life. Priest number 10, Archibald Lynn, of sufficient learning, but is somewhat given to drinking. In his youth he had children, but 10 years ago he sent away his mistress. Priest 11, Bernard O'Mulgerick, of sufficient learning and good life. Priest 12, Patrick McGarry, of good life and sufficient learning. And priest number 12, Edmund O'Moore, and number 13, Edmund O'Moore, and 14, James McHugganon, also of good life and sufficient learning. Now, when you recall, you're probably a little bit shocked about those references to the priest, but when you recall that in the 1670s, when Blessed Oliver came to Ireland, there was no seminary system in Ireland, that most of these poor men had simply offered themselves for the priesthood. They had no chance of getting very much learning. They weren't able to attend any foreign universities, as Blessed Oliver himself got the chance of doing. They didn't have any long period, as it were, of proving themselves. They just, in order to continue the sacramental life of the church, had to be ordained if they were willing and offer themselves for service in the church. When you consider all that, when you consider that some of them in fact had come through the Cromwellian period and all the persecution of that time, and have still maintained fidelity to their religion in spite of all the persecution, then it's a very good record indeed. Don't be in any way shocked if there were a couple of men who didn't come up to what nowadays we might demand, as it were, as the proper standards. As well as these reports on the diocese of Donnacolor and of the priests, Blessed Oliver, in many other letters, of course, refers to the need for an improvement in the standard of education of the priests in the north, and the need also for an improvement in what you might call the discipline and the general moral standards which he would demand of the clergy. And for that reason, as I said already, he set out to found a number of schools in County Louth which would serve the double purpose of providing candidates for the priesthood, and secondly would provide also a kind of refresher course for some of these priests who hadn't got perhaps a sufficiency of learning at the time. We know a lot about the amount of learning that the priests of the late 17th century had, because a couple of years ago there was published a very interesting satire on their learning by a priest who will be known to some of the men in the hall tonight, Father Joe Duffy of Clogher Diocese. It's an Irish satire called Corlia Viclavo Athanum Willem, the advice of McLav, of Achnamullan, which is a parish in County Monaghan. It's a long poem in Irish with various prose passages interspersed through it. And he's writing, as it were, supposedly an old priest who was able to manage through life with a little smattering of Latin. And the whole thing is satire, of course, and he's advising a young up-and-coming cleric, don't worry too much about if your Latin's not too good. You'll be able to get by all right. And don't worry too much if you haven't a very good knowledge of theology and so on. The people are very good, and they'll forgive you a lot. And perhaps just to as it were, throw a little bit of light on this question of the learning which Blessed Oliver's priests had, I might just read you, at least in translation, a verse or two from it. The old priest starts off by saying, Abrahar Arsi, Brother Archie, he says, may you live to enjoy the state of your new priesthood. But I pray you, don't be too depressed because of the poverty of your Latin, as the amount of Latin necessary for saying Mass for the common congregation is slight, compared with your arrogance. I am, he says, a person who has been subjected to many tests, and so I'm able to tell you. When you go into the chapel on beginning the Introibo, Mass was obviously still being said in Latin in those days, on beginning the Introibo, bless yourself, he says, with a loud, full voice, and give your vigorous body a firm, sturdy aspect, and let your two eyes be sloping and haggish in your head while looking at the Lord, and utter this Introibo in a loud, uncouth voice, so that sound and echo will pervade the entire congregation. And then utter the second verse in a solemn, tuneful voice like chanting, and from that on in every variety of voice, robustly and harshly, and in another part spluttering and stammering and muttering through your teeth until they come to the last verse. And then raise your voice to a song and coughing, and the wealthy boors among the congregation will say, how great a pity it is, the shortness of breath and the congestion of the chest that have addicted you during the service, this blessed loud voice priest, and so on. Well, he goes on in that kind of tone. And then, as I say, he puts in some verses to suit. And the whole thing is very hilarious. And he explains then how the young student should do when he's finally called to prove his knowledge of Latin before the bishop. And he says he'd tell him a story to show how he can get by with very much Latin. And it's a story he composes about a young man who was going to be examined in Latin by the bishop. And the bishop, according to this story, was living on an island in the shadow of Clonmacnoise in Loch Ree, I suppose, and he finally, himself and his father, went over to the island, and the bishop comes out to meet the young man, and he says, now sit down, I'm going to examine your Latin. And the first question he asks him is, quid est sacramentum in nomine Domini? And remembering, of course, that at that time Mass was being said in Latin, the young man answers, qui fecit coelum et terram. The priest will appreciate this. This was the continuation of that particular phrase in the Mass long ago. That was the answer to that one. And then the bishop says to him, his Latin is so bad, nunquam accedes ad altare Dei. You'll never go to the altar of God. And the young man replies, that Deum qui litificat you. And finally, after a lot of backwards and forwards of that kind, the bishop says to him, stolide, fool, non fies sacerdos per me in secula seculorum. Fool, you'll never be made a priest by me in secula seculorum. And of course the young man says, amen, amen. Well, the whole thing is quite hilarious, but it does bring out, it was written just at Blessed Oliver's time, and it does bring out that kind of necessity of making do with a very minimum of Latin, of learning, and even of theology in the atmosphere of Ireland immediately after the Cromwellian period. Now, the young men that were educated by Blessed Oliver in his schools in County Louth and that were ordained by him, as I said, included a number from County Antrim. And the names that are given are Henry O'Duffin, who was parish priest of Ahochel, Patrick Durnan, who was parish priest of Lisburn and Crumlin, John McGinn, who was parish priest of Ballycloak, Kiri and Rakhavan, if my pronunciation of these names is a little bit off, don't mind them. And Patrick McInmurray, who was parish priest of Ahalee and Ahigallan. There is a possibility that there was a fifth, but those four certainly still survived to 1704 and had all been ordained by Blessed Oliver. Secondly, there is the question, as you noticed in that report of the priests of Antrim, that he felt some of them were a little bit too fond of alcohol. And with regard to this visitation of the north, when he got back to Armagh, he writes a letter there with regard to this business, and it's very interesting from the Donald Connor point of view, as you'll see in a moment. While on visitation in six dioceses in this province, he says, I noted that the vice which prevails is the excessive drinking of beer, and especially whiskey. And what is more, this takes place in taverns, so that many other scandals result. Very often the drinker does not know what he is doing because his powers of reasoning are disturbed. The man who has the perfect use of his reason at least behaves cautiously and with some degree of prudence, while the drunkard does scandalous things without any care for what he does. I gave a great deal of attention to trying to eradicate this cursed vice, which is mother and nurse to all sorts of scandals and disputes. I ordered, under pain of privation of benefice, that priests should refrain from frequenting taverns and from drinking whiskey, and indeed the results are very gratifying. These 6 months passed, only two priests, and this on one occasion only, were drunk. And since deeds speak louder than words, I never take a drink between meals myself. Let us remove this defect from an Irish priest, and he will be a saint. Strangely enough, after that general introduction on the clergy of the north as a whole, he then brings up a question which was disturbing him at the time, that he had just heard that a new bishop of Downonconnor had been appointed. And from his knowledge of this man in the past, he felt that perhaps this man was a little bit too fond of the bottle himself. So he goes on to say, still I fear that I have laboured in vain, if what is written from various quarters is true, namely that a certain Father Daniel McKay, chaplain to Don Pedro of Aragon, has been appointed Bishop of Downonconnor. This man is not of a very prominent family, nor is he very impressive as regards bodily presence. I admit he is a man of some learning, but in the matter of drink, he exceeds. And this is public knowledge with all who have known him in Rome or Naples or anywhere else. What will the priests of Downonconnor do when they see their bishop affected by excessive drinking? According to the king's example is a good proverb, he says. Now the remedy is to write to Bishop McKay a very strong letter, warning him not to give any bad example in the matter of drink in this country, now that what has done cannot be undone. He's been already appointed, he couldn't be, as it were, de-appointed, so the only thing to do was to make sure that he would be well warned. So later on, in a later letter, Blessed Oliver is still worried a little bit about him. As regards Father Daniel Mackey, he says, already appointed Bishop of Downonconnor, all say that he is a very good and moderate man and of sufficient learning, but he is too fond of the bottle and the tavern, and it will be necessary to issue him a strong warning to abstain from drinking here. However, when Daniel Mackey finally arrived in Ireland, he was, as you know, the only Bishop of Downonconnor during the latter part of the 18th century, of the 17th century at all. There had been no bishop in Downonconnor from Cromwellian times, from the death of Arthur McGuinness, until Daniel McKay was appointed in 1671. And he survived for only 2 years. He arrived in Ireland at the end of 1671, and he died on Christmas Eve of 1673. And after his time, again, there's a long interregnum of about 30 years or more, when Downonconnor was ruled by vicars and when there was no bishop. So I'm sure the poor people of Downonconnor were delighted to hear that they were getting this bishop at any rate, but Oliver, obviously, well, at the beginning he had doubts about him, but later on, when he arrived in Ireland, he found things weren't so bad as he had feared. Bishop McKay of Down, he says, arrived last Christmas. He is a good person. I do not know if he has written to you yet since his coming here. I lectured him on the subject of drinking, and really he mended his ways considerably. Written from Armagh, the 19th of July, 1672. Well, Bishop McKay, as I said, was destined only to survive for another year after that. And after his death at Christmas, 1673, Blessed Oliver wrote to Rome to let them know of his death. Just at the end of 1673, an edict had been issued by the new Viceroy of Essex, ordering all bishops to leave the country. And Blessed Oliver in this letter shows a little bit of sense of humour, because he says, on Christmas Eve, Monsignor McKay, Bishop of Dunanconor, gave perfect obedience to the recent edict of the Viceroy. He departed not only from Ireland, but from this world altogether. And now he enjoys, I hope, a homeland where he will have no further fear of the Parliament of England and its edicts. He was a good theologian, educated in Spain, and chaplain for many years to Don Pedro of Aragon, who, being ambassador extraordinary 3 years ago to Pope Clement X, our present pontiff, obtained from His Holiness that his chaplain should be appointed bishop in his own country. This promotion did not please Monsignor Baldeschi, the Secretary of Propaganda, because this good prelate was somewhat too fond of the taverns, where he eventually ended his days, not having a halfpenny more than 35 baiacci, so that to give him even a very private funeral, it was necessary to sell some of his belongings. And then, having been introduced into money matters, he goes on to point out how poor all the Irish bishoprics are, that his own diocese was able to contribute 248 scudi per year. That would be £62 as his annual revenue, and he comes right down among them to Dunanconor, that gave its bishop £25 per annum at the time. Well, I'm sure on £25 per annum, poor Daniel McKay couldn't have very much in his pocket at the end, whether he took another drink or not. Now, during that first visit of Blessed Oliver to County Antrim, he decided to come on up to visit the Earl of Antrim at Dunluce Castle. And the main reason for his visit here was that before leaving Rome, he'd been given a commission by Rome to inquire into the state of Catholicism on the islands of the Hebrides, on the Catholic islands there, like Barra, and if possible to send a number of priests over from County Antrim to provide the sacraments for the Catholic islanders, and even, if he could do so, to visit them himself. So his first letter from Dunluce is with regard to his decision not for the moment to visit the Hebrides. The reason I decided not to go to the Hebrides was contained in a letter I wrote to your lordship a short while ago. And it is that all this summer there have been negotiations to unite the crown of Scotland to that of England, and to have both governed by the same laws. And this union is opposed by the islanders. So if I were to go to the islands, our enemies would say that I had gone to impede the union and upset the plans for it. This was also the opinion of the Marquis of Antrim, a Catholic gentleman who has a great following on those islands. And it was also the opinion of Patrick Mulderig, Vicar General of Connor, who has often been to those islands and is a man of mature judgment. Later on, writing on the 23rd of February 1671, Oliver goes more fully into this question of the Hebrides and of his visit to the Marquis of Antrim in Dunluce. This was the Marquis, by the way, I think, isn't he called the Grand Marquis or something like that? He's buried in Fundamargy Friary in the MacDonald vault there. He's the man on whose coffin there used to be, at any rate, as recorded by Francis Joseph Biggar, a trilingual inscription in Irish, English and Latin. He died only a few months, in fact, after Oliver himself, because he died in February 1682. And he was married twice, I think. He was married first of all to the daughter of O'Neill of Clanmacoy of Shane's Castle. No, he was married secondly to her. He was married firstly to the widow of the of Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, isn't that right? But in fact, they had no children of either marriage. At any rate, Oliver, as I said, visited him, and this is what he has to say. There remains the question of the Hebrides, but if you do not write a letter to the Marquis of Antrim, we shall accomplish nothing. This gentleman is very powerful in those islands, but he is just like Monsignor Alberici. This letter is being written to the Secretary of Propaganda in Rome, and Alberici had been the previous secretary, so he's able to talk to the present secretary with regard to his predecessor. He is just, he says, like Monsignor Alberici. He is a wise man, but slow to act and full of scruples. I remember that servants could not be found for Monsignor Alberici in the whole of Italy. The Florentine was a charlatan, the Milanese was a stupid fellow, the Marquesan was mulish, the Neapolitan light-fingered, the Roman gloomy. In the same way, the Marquis of Antrim is hard to please. I proposed more than 20 priests to him to go to the Hebrides, but he found something wrong with each of them. And even against Ronan McGinn, McGinn was a County Down man near Hillsborough, and even against Ronan McGinn, a worthy man, he finds the difficulty that he seems too bold and presumptuous and proud. But the real obstacle is the treaty for the union of Scotland with England, as I have written on other occasions. The Marquis, at his own expense, has sent 3 priests to those islands, praising his piety and his solicitude for the spiritual welfare of those souls, and praising also his ancestors, would advance this matter considerably. I spent 3 days with him in his residence at Dunluce, a noble place. The castle is situated on a big rock, washed all around by the sea, and it is only 12 miles from the largest of the Hebrides. My lord, this letter to him is a must, because the Marquis is the only Catholic gentleman who can help me in this affair, and without him I should run a great risk. My paper is now at an end, and I shall never fail to be your most affectionate and obliged servant from Dundalk, 23rd of February, 1671. That little touch at the end is very common in Blessed Oliver's letters. He's in the middle of something, and then his paper runs out, and he perhaps writes up a line or two on the side of it and says, "Sorry, no more space, off you go." On one occasion, a very human thing happened to him. Just as the letter was ready to go off with the messenger to Dublin to catch the post, his servant came in and spilled a bottle of ink over the letter. And he just writes, "The servant has spilled the ink on the letter, sent it off to Rome, and is there in Rome to the present day with the ink spilled over the letter just as it came from his hand 300 years ago." One of the interesting references that I mentioned in his letters to Darren Connor was this reference to 4 nuns. And on another occasion he refers also to a Darren Connor girl who had intended to become a nun but didn't. And this again is one of the very few references to nuns in Ireland at the end of the 17th century. We do know that there was a Poor Clare convent in Galway at that time. Now I think you have a tradition up here of a nun from the middle or latter part of the 17th century. Somebody, the black nun of Bunnamargy, isn't that right, being buried in Bunnamargy by the name of Julia McQuillan. As you see, I was reading in preparation what Francis Joseph Bigger had to say about Bunnamargy, and it's quite possible, in fact, that she was one of those 4 mentioned by Blessed Oliver, so that possibly it was in the Bunnamargy area these 4 Franciscan devotees were. But here is another girl from Donnacolor. He says, "There is in my province a young girl of gentle birth whose name is Rose O'Hara of the Diocese of Down-on-Connor. She is a Catholic, but her father and mother are non-Catholics. This girl made a simple vow of chastity and also vowed to become a nun. But in this country there are no convents, and if she wished to go abroad, her relatives being non-Catholics would not give her a penny. Now this girl, seeing the moral impossibility of becoming a nun, and having found a Catholic husband, begs your lordship to dispense her from her vow. And if you have not the faculty to dispense, I ask you to procure it from our superiors. He's writing to the Internuncio, and he wants him, if he has the faculties, if not, to get Rome to dispense her from the vow she has taken. As well as referring to the clergy of Derrynconnor, Blessed Oliver, on occasions in his letters, refers to the Protestants of this part of the world. And perhaps I might read you just one of his comments on the Protestants of Antrim. He says, in the diocese of Derrynconnor, as in some others, there is a large number of Presbyterians, who are very numerous in Ulster, also Anabaptists and Quakers, and therefore these dioceses are very poor, and their bishops are poverty-stricken and wretched. What he means is, of course, there are a lot of people who are not Catholics, and therefore the Catholic bishops are poor. It is notable that here the Presbyterians, whose belief is a form of Protestantism, are more numerous than Catholics and Protestants put together. They have no time for bishops or ordinations, but govern themselves by a presbyterium, that is, the elders of each district. They are the enemies of hierarchy and have little love for monarchy. They adhere closely to the institutions of Calvin. In every district they have a preacher who is under the control of the presbyterium. These preachers promise fire and brimstone. Their preachers have no income, but every Presbyterian householder gives them so much per year. This reference to the Presbyterians of County Antrim naturally raises the question as to Blessed Oliver's relationship with the other churches in Ireland at the time. And I'd just like to say one word about that, if I may, before I conclude. When you examine his letters and the records he gives of his associations with the various Protestant churches in the north of Ireland and in fact elsewhere, I think it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that Oliver Plunkett was an ecumenist before his time. Very shortly after his arrival in Ireland, the Protestant Archbishop, or the Church of Ireland Archbishop of Armagh at that time, Archbishop Margeson, expressed a wish to meet the new Catholic Archbishop. And Oliver visited him, and this is what he writes about him. The Protestant primate, he says, asked to speak to me, and I visited him, and he gave me precedence in his own house, as well as those titles which belonged to me. We had a meeting of an hour's duration, and he promised me he would never interfere.